I just check. Owen, is there a red light and there's a box
green,
underneath there?
Green and red.
Yeah.
Green and red, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's recording. Okay.
Yeah. Right. Okay, so episode 11, we have two guests on with us today. So from Irish Strength Institute, Adam Ward and Owen Lacey. We're going to give a wee introduction to Owen and Adam. Noel had his own theory of Owen's introduction into the fitness industry, and we'll get Owen to elaborate on it a wee bit. Okay, so Noel's theory was that he was put into a lab in ISI in Dublin and fed educational steroids, which meant that he learned 30 times faster than everybody else. So is that true, Owen, or how did you start out?
23.3%.
So do you want to give us a wee bit of background how you actually get involved in the fitness industry?
Well, actually, first of all, I wanted to go to the army. That's what I wanted to do initially, to be an electrician. And I realised that they needed 9 years commitment, so that quickly went out the window. And I play football. I've played football since I've been about 5 or 6, and I always seemed to be the captain for whatever reason. Maybe I had the biggest mouth. It wasn't because I was the best football player, that's for sure. So doing the warm-up and cool-downs for a football team, just I sort of got the interest in fitness and training. And then when I decided not to be an electrician after school, I decided to go into fitness and leisure management. And my dad, I remember my dad telling me, he said, "Owen, so like, what, wearing big socks and jumping around the place?" And not exactly aerobics, Dad, but yeah, that's what he thought it was about. So that's initially how it started. I was playing football, I liked coaching, warming up, and then I found that I wanted to do a job that was different. That was 1996, yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah. What about yourself, Adam?
Something similar to Owen. I actually wanted to be a guard.
Right.
So my sister's a guard and I wanted to kind of go down that road. And then the recession came in and they weren't recruiting. So I went into the Garda Reserve program, which was basically where you had to work voluntarily. But if you did want to be a guard, you had to have done that. So I did that and did the training down in Templemore, and then just wasn't for me. And I was never the most athletic growing up, but I tried every different sport going and did it for a year, 2 years, and then never got into it. And then when I started training with Owen and Stephen, I just knew I loved it, and it was just something different. And then, you know, started interning with them, and then they recommended what courses for me to go on, and that's what I did. So
brilliant. Yeah, yeah. I suppose it was not nearly a natural transition, but because it was there in front of you, it seemed right, just with Stephen and the one there.
I think for me, the fact that I'd stand in and I'd watch him train, I'd see the different dimensions that, like, what it wasn't just training people, like, you know, and that's, I was exposed to that from day one.
Yeah.
Before I even thought about doing any courses, like, I was like, shit, this is more than I thought it was, like, you know, so.
Brilliant. So, like, with Adam had that kind of on his doorstep with Stephen and yourself. Yeah. What was your initial step through?
Getting qualified?
Yeah, being a personal trainer, yeah.
So initially, the first course I did was the fitness and leisure management. Yeah. And I got enrolled in the course after my leaving cert. Course starts in September, but there was a gym just open called Total Fitness.
Yeah.
It was at that point was Ireland's biggest gym. So I went up, cocky as can be. He said, "How are you getting on?" I just enrolled in the course in September. This was maybe July or August, and they go, "Yeah, we'll give you a job as a leisure attendant." So basically means a cleaner with a fitness teacher. So that's what I did. So I worked there all through college, but I remember I got £1.50 an hour. You know what a pound is?
Yeah, I know what a pound is. I'm not that young.
Punt?
So, yeah, punt. Yeah, exactly. £1.50 an hour. So I did that all through college. So I actually got my first fitness job before I started my first fitness course. And that was 2 years full time. So, yeah, that's how it happened.
Yeah. So from there, what happened?
You didn't get any other courses after that, no?
Oh,
just started teaching.
Yeah, just a few, yeah.
Yeah. That's done you throughout, man. Surely you just need one course.
As I say all the time, a course is just like your license to begin your journey. Just to start. So, and then from Total Fitness, I went to a club called Westwood, which was huge. It's still a huge club, but it's a very commercial club.
Yeah.
So being there for, I don't know how long I was there, I was in Total Fitness for 4 or 5 years, Westwood for maybe 6 or 7 years. It's just about membership, and that's not all I'm about.
Yeah.
Members are just getting in, getting out, keeping your membership at a certain level, not looking after people. And that's when I went to, I don't know if you're familiar with Paul Check.
Yeah.
So Paul Check started doing a lot of Swiss ball training.
Yeah.
So my job in the gym at that point was a program director looking after staff training. And all these gym balls start coming around and people were standing on them and falling off them and doing abs on them and killing themselves. I'm like going, hang on a second, barbells, dumbbells, bench presses, we know. But these Swiss ball stuff, people don't understand how to use them. So Paul Check had a certification course on Swiss ball training. So I contacted Paul. I said, look, I've 17 staff. Will you do me a deal on the course? He said, no. I said, thanks, Paul. I said, what can you do? He said, tell you what I'll do. I'll give you 17 courses and exams, but only three sets of the cassettes, VHSs. They're black things, but they're size. So basically, we had three sets of the videos, and everyone had the manual. And that was my first introduction to sort of corrective exercise and Charles Pollock. And from there, I really liked corrective exercise. So I went back to college to study physical therapy. And John Connor, one of the other guys in the gym, he went down the Czech route and did some of Paul Czech's levels. So, so that's one direction that we went.
And did you... Obviously, did you grow up knowing John? Was that?
No, it's funny because in that gym, Westwood, John, you won't like me saying this, but John worked in the teen gym. So the gym was massive. Yeah. It's huge. He worked in the teen gym. So I was on the main gym floor, you know, with Stephen, Adam's brother. We worked on the main gym floor. John was in another gym. So that's how we got together.
All right, okay.
And when I left that gym to set up my own gym. And then John wanted to start running courses, which is interesting. John wanted to run courses and bring people like Charles Pollockin over, Paul Check over. So he said, would you want to get involved in the business, and you, and we'll bring people over to help educate ourselves. So the name of our company, the Irish Strength Institute, had no intention ever being a gym. I already had my own gym. It was separate. And John said, let's set up a company to educate. So without being... We did want to educate Irish trainers. That was our goal, but we were a bit selfish.
Yeah.
So a bit more mainstreamism. We brought people over to educate ourselves.
Yeah.
And then we divide the cost of these speakers by the people that came.
Yeah.
And that's how the Irish Strength Institute started. It wasn't meant to be a gym.
Brilliant.
And then as we evolved and learned all this new stuff, I had my gym, which wasn't suitable for what I wanted to do. And John was in Westwood, which wasn't suitable for him. So then we said, well, why don't we open our own gym to do what we need to do?
Yeah.
That's how the first gym started.
How did that, obviously you mentioned Charles Pollockin.
Yeah.
And you worked with Charles then for...
For Charles, in total, 7 years.
How did that kind of come about? Just through bringing him over? And
so Charles is rest his soul, he's dead now, but he's a great guy. But when he came over initially, he'd just sit down, he'd do a seminar. Let's say we did a seminar yesterday, and he'd say, okay, I'm going to talk about fat loss. And he'd do the same seminar somewhere else, and it would be completely different content. So I said, he'd come to Ireland a few times, and said, Charles, you can't keep changing things. People expect, like, it's good to have different content, but you need to deliver the same sort of thing, you know. So he said, what do you mean? I said, well, why don't you systemize it, put a structure together. This is what my level one looks like, this is what my level two looks like, this is what special consideration looks like. He said, okay, well, why don't you do that? So me and John sat down and we basically structured all the PCP programs in with Andre Benoit. So Charles was like, okay, you help us do that and then come with me, travel around with me, see the content that I deliver and you help me structure this program together, which we did. And then he's like, bit by bit, he sort of stepped back a little bit. So at one point, the year I left, which is another funny story, the year I left, I had 152 teaching days. That's teaching days, that's not travel days. So like, we were in Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, everywhere in the world. At one point I went over, Christian Thibodeau was actually on the course, a level one in Montreal. So I rock up, you know, a white pale Irish guy to teach a course in Montreal. Nobody speaks Irish or English even, and only French. I'm like, how the hell am I going to teach this course? So it was interesting.
So obviously, like, Charles Pollockin, as you say, is dead now, but he was a massive influence in the fitness industry.
Huge guy. And it's interesting, he's a lot of stuff that Charles would have come up with wasn't his content.
Yeah.
A lot of the stuff that he would get out there was stuff that he'd learned from other people. He did understand German, understand a lot of Russian, so he got a lot of information from there. But he popularized a lot of concepts. Sometimes people gave him shit for saying that he made it up. He didn't say he made it up, but he popularized a lot of methods.
Yeah. Was there something in particular that you kind of learned from him, like watching him and how he operated in terms of business, or there was probably a lot of stuff that you learned from him that you didn't want to apply?
You know what? That's one thing. He I learned a lot what not to do than what to do, if that makes sense. And that's not being bad. But he's with gyms, with business models, with training, with mindset, he would have been quite a fixed mindset person. Yeah. As in, this is my system. Where you have to open your mind. You have to be like, you would never see Charles with a kettlebell. With Janie Mack, you get a kick in the ass, you had a kettlebell in your hand. So that's something different. So you have to be more open. In this industry, in this field, with dealing with people, you need to be more open.
Yeah, I heard about some of his lectures, his talks and stuff, people asking like stupid questions, he would come down hard on them.
Yeah, and that's...
You need to be afraid to ask a question.
And that would be one of the things we got. We used to always ask for feedback. Every seminar we gave, we asked for feedback from the attendees. Because for me and Adam's exact same. When you come to a seminar, it's about the attendees. Yeah. It's always about the attendees. The minute you make it about yourself, that you're done.
Yeah.
So, but unfortunately, sometimes Charles wouldn't make it a harmonious environment for the attendees to ask questions. And I'm saying that lightly. He used to have a certain phrase he'd say. Yeah. Stupid question. I wouldn't tolerate that.
So starting out again, back to kind of starting the gym, the whole setup. You started one, which was your first one? Was it Gleeson?
On my own, was in Colester.
No, with the ASA.
The first ASA was in Dumcondra.
Right, okay. Yeah. Looking back, what would you have done different in terms of the setup? Would it have been equipment-wise? For guys that are starting out in personal training, they put a lot of emphasis on, we need to get this right in terms of equipment and buy this machine and buy that machine, etc. And waste a lot of money, time, effort.
How much money would you spend? We probably spent... Without exaggeration, about €200,000 on a gym.
Yeah.
And we had no clients. It was the stupidest thing I've ever done in my life. Now, I didn't have €200,000 to spend on equipment. I'm not trying to say I had that. But what we did was, for tax reasons, maybe I shouldn't say that. what we do is we'd work for Charles. Cut that back.
No, but that's an edit moment there, for sure.
But what we do is, for Atlantis equipment, for example. Mm. So we bought all Atlantis equipment for our gym. So Atlantis never sold equipment to Europe. So they said, would you like to sell our equipment? So we're like going, so that could be an option. So we set up as a European distributor of Atlantis, purely selfishly to get it at half price for the gym. And then we bought all Aleco stuff. We bought all Black Iron Strength. But stupidly, I'm not saying I don't like the equipment. It's phenomenal. But we put money into a business to have it. For nice to have, not need to have.
Trainers do that, don't they?
Do you know what? It's just passion. Like, you know what's good. And the same way as you created Irish Strength Institute, you created it for yourself and John.
Yeah.
And then it came together as something obviously different where you could teach other people. Same idea, like your passion leads you away and business kind of gets set to the back burner. If someone came to you and said, right, you need £200,000 to set up this business, you're not guaranteed any clients, and if it was completely outside the fitness field, you would say, that's fucking ridiculous.
Yeah.
Let's not do that. Like, let's start small and build it up.
Exactly.
But the fact that you're in it, you're in the bubble, and you can't see outside it, and you think, no, this is the best of stuff. Yeah. I need the best.
Yeah.
You know, the same way as you need the best speakers coming over, you know, you need...
Yeah. And when we opened a city centre gym, and we basically, one of the gyms Stephen was walking in was closing down, it was going bust, and he had quite an established personal training business and there's a lot of clients in it. So we said, look, this is closing down, why don't we capitalise in this situation? And we got our premises and we turned the gym around. I think we maybe spent €10,000. The gym was up and operational.
Yes.
And we had, like, I think the fourth week, I think we hit something like 40 personal training sessions from the one.
Brilliant. Gym,
and it was only open.
Yeah.
But it was tiny.
It was tiny.
700 or 800 square feet, like.
It was efficient, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And the equipment was quality. The equipment was quality, but it wasn't over the top. But it did what it needed to do. You know?
Yeah, but guys do that, especially personal trainers. They build the gym, do how they like.
Yeah.
And not thinking about their members or who they're actually trying to train. And they go in, as you say, they go in and spend a lot of dough and equipment that they don't basically need.
And you know, one of my, again, I don't want to be slagging people off, but I got a job for Life Fitness. So Life Fitness approached me one time. I was in a gym training someone and this girl came over. She was the head of Life Fitness in Ireland. She said, oh, I really like how you explained to that client. Would you mind if I brought you in to train people when I sell them equipment? So for about 4 years, I would travel around. When a gym was put in, they bought about 40 pieces of cardio, 10 pieces of strength. I go in and do the staff training. So we did it all over the place. But the money they make off cardio equipment is through the roof.
Crazy.
It's crazy. And then they have a single-use machine, a lat pull down, a bench press, whatever, and like a chest press, obviously stack. Huge money. But that's not a gym. That you've been sold a gym.
Yeah.
You know? I consulted for a gym over in Portugal called The Campus, and it ended up going a different direction. But the gym was built by gym people, by equipment suppliers, not by gym users or gym managers. So it wasn't built for purpose.
No.
It was built for
selling machines.
Yeah. Like techno gym, not slagging off techno gym, but they're terrible. But but it look like the seats. It just isn't designed by someone that trains.
Yeah.
The facility, the usage, the like even Ben Dunn has a number of gyms, and his dumbbell rack goes from 2.5 kilos to 30 kilos 3 times in the gym.
Mm-hmm.
Because he doesn't want to have heavy dumbbells, like it just it's not designed correctly, you know. So it's
So Adam, your personal training, how long now? I
think just coming up on 6 years now.
Yeah, because I mean the mentorship program I went with the Portugal, you were just kind of just starting them, weren't you?
Yeah, I think that was probably was it in a year then at that stage,
7 years ago now, isn't it?
Yeah, I remember you were over doing the internship.
Yeah,
and that was my first one. So I pretty much in order to be able to run them, I had to go over and basically shadow how they were ran for 2 or 3 occasions. So now I'm up and going with them. But yeah, you remember you being there, yeah.
Yeah, and did you, like starting out, did you have any kind of fears as in, am I doing this right there? Now, what advice would you give to somebody kind of starting out now who was maybe you 6 years ago?
Surround yourself by people that are positive, that kind of have come from where you're coming from in that way. Like, you know, so like I was around them guys and I was like seeing them learn off others and I was like, right, so they're always learning, so that means I need to, because I know how far I'm behind them.
Yeah.
And you know, you could be around, you could be in one class and you're like, oh, I'm not too bad in this class, and then you go to Artane, which Artane was the hub at the time before Malahide was the way it is now, Centre of Excellence. But we'd go to Artane and I'd hear him and John and I'd hear Mick and I'd be like,
okay, yeah,
like, you know, yeah, I'm a long way away from this, like, you know. Yeah. so like now I'd feel like I can sit there and have a conversation with them and be in it, like, you know. So yeah, just you know, Owen's mentioned before, I'm not sure who said it, but if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room.
Yeah, definitely.
So, like, I've no problem always being a student. No problem with it at all, yeah. You know.
I think that's what you should be, you know. Like, really, if you're going to... That's, as somebody said yesterday, I think it was actually Gareth that works for us. He says he, in his previous job, he worked in a factory for 17 years, felt like he knew it all.
Yeah.
And he knows, like, in this job, but he's never ever going to know it all. It's always expanding. He's always has to keep learning, keep educating himself.
We try to study all the time. So we'll walk in the gym on any random day, say, what did you study today, Adam? And Adam shares something that he learned, or Robbie or Sarah or Hannah. The point being is, when that ethos is around, people are always studying.
Yeah.
And one of the things we really like, when you learn something, when you study something, and you have to teach it to someone else or share it with someone else, you retain the information much better.
Yeah.
So you read an article on carnitine, and then you realise how it works. When you say, well, actually, Owen might ask me, well, what form of carnitine, or how much carnitine, and what time of the day? So I'm going to have to know this if he asks me.
Yeah.
So you just do this, a little banter in the gym. Yeah. What did you learn today? And if you didn't learn something...
There's a certain amount of pressure there.
Yeah. And it's a great way for information retention. And I see people, and one of my things I love is accelerated learning, not by steroids, but by studying different ways.
Lies, we're testing you after.
yeah, piss test. But when you study something, get usable information from it and share it with someone. And when you share it with someone, it stays. It really does.
The tips even you give before the seminar yesterday were great.
Yeah.
You know, the way you write it out and how you can kind of stick in your mind. And brilliant. And this is all about learning and how much you can actually retain. Now, not that you're just going to be a memory bank of fucking passing back information, but using it as a practical application, which we talked about yesterday, the kind of void between theory and actual practical application. Like it is, there can be that gap, and experience is everything. Like, and I think I spoke about it at the end of the seminar yesterday about people getting closed, personal trainers getting closed mindsets to, you know, the calorie model essentially, and if it's outside of that, then they don't want to know, or they're not thinking. It's like almost like a cognitive tunneling, that they're fucking just focusing on one aspect and they're not seeing like bigger picture. So that it really opened me up yesterday, the seminar, in terms of, you know, thinking outside the box, as Seamus put it, like, and it's great to go back to that kind of learning experience.
On what we did a couple of years ago, Dr. Lane Norton, I did a course, well, a few courses with the IWSN, so International Society of Sports Nutrition. So I'm their Irish ambassador, only for the fact that myself and Jose are friends, and I brought Jose over a few times. But Dr. Lane Norton is a big advocate of if it fits your macros.
Yeah, that's right.
And a lot of the guys would adhere to that on the courses. So I said, okay, look, I don't know too much about them. So I had one of the guys in the gym, Luke, research all his content and send it to me. So I looked it up. I said, oh, you know what? This guy is a clever guy. He switched on. He's done his research. Well, why don't I bring him to the gym? Why don't I pay for him to come over, spend a day in the gym and teach all his methods? So he did. He came. So then I wouldn't challenge someone. I'm not going to put someone on the spot. But I asked him some questions. And the answer to nearly every single question I asked him was, It depends.
Yeah.
Well, what about this? Well, it depends on the client. So people see him saying, oh, it's calories, calories, calories. It is. But it's person specific. And that's what we talked about all day yesterday.
Yeah.
So people like this easy system, but it's not easy. It's for a general standpoint, yes.
Yeah.
But when it comes to people, it's all individual.
Yeah, because there's a lot of, obviously, there's a lot of factors at play under there. Like saying that if it just fits your macros or just kind of eat whatever you want. When you think of somebody that's coming from like an obese background that has all the psychology and linked under those foods and triggers and like saying that you can just eat when you want, that just leads into days and days and days of binging.
Yeah,
and it's so hard for that person to actually stop and scale things back again. Like.
Yeah,
we need to question, like, you know, I always think that there should be questions asked about everything, every model, and you know, even research papers. There's always going to be questions asked, and they never, nothing's set in stone, concrete.
Yeah.
And I was reading a book recently, Charles Duhigg, Better, Faster, Stronger. I think Marty was telling us to look it up. Anyway, it was basically about a nurse who worked in NNICU, so neonatal intensive care for babies. And basically she was passing the baby one day and all the vitals were flying. The baby was feeding well, everything looked good. And she stopped at the baby, looked at it, and basically called for the doctor immediately to get antibiotics to the baby because she seen there was something wrong. Now, everything looked right from the outside.
Yeah.
You know, everything was kind of matching up, but she thought there was something wrong in her head. Something clicked and it was actually sepsis and the baby was dying, but they didn't know. And it's like just, you know, the principles work for most things and the vitals will be right for everyone, but there could just be that one person that falls outside the fucking box, you know?
Yeah, 100%. And like, you know, the 80-20 rule,
credit
principle. Like 80% of the people, if they cut down the amount of food they eat, they lose weight.
Yeah.
That's fine, but that's 80% of the people.
Yeah.
So it's 20% of the people that may have had digestive problems or problems in the past or babies, whatever it may be, they need a bit more attention. Mm. They just do. Dr. Mark Hyman, he's a big fan of food is information to the body. So when you eat food, it speaks to your cells, it speaks to your body, and what question is it asking? So I know Lane Norton gets a hard time for promoting Pop-Tarts. He didn't promote Pop-Tarts. He just said if he was low on his carb intake, having a Pop-Tart wouldn't be the worst thing in the world.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be recommending.
And the thing is, you have to take into account there as well too, is a lot of those guys are bodybuilders, you know, and they're using other methods to be able to be at that stage, which lets their metabolism kind of be able to deal with all those calories and deal with all those sugars. And
is this on lean or?
No, I mean in general, but no, but I'm saying in general, it has like a lot of that is focused around those because a lot of guys are following bodybuilders and their diets and everything else.
And even the muscle the
general,
mass.
Yeah, exactly. In general population, like the average person is looking to lose a bit of weight who can't handle those types of things and are looking at that on Instagram and looking at that on social media and thinking, well, if this guy's doing it, look at the shape he's in, I can do it and follow it too.
The issue that I have, I am... Well, I don't want to go off on one, but I got two articles for the very first time publishing Muscle and Fitness online. And I got the copy of the magazine just because my articles were in it. And every single picture in the magazine is guys and girls on steroids.
Yeah.
So, come here, I don't, whatever you want to do is whatever you want to do. But nutrition and training recommendations for an assisted athlete in comparison to Joe Sobe are worlds apart.
Yeah.
Worlds apart. So, when we see these programs of high volume training multiple times a day, eat this, eat that, that's fine for an athlete or someone on enhancement, but for a normal Joe Soap, it's nearly liable that you can't be giving people that recommendation because they will not get the results. They'll kill themselves aspiring to this and not get it, you know.
But
even from a celebrity point of view, people following celebrities online, you don't have their life. You know, you mind your own kids. They have people that mind their kids. They have people that wipe their kids' ass. You know, so when people look and it's like, oh, Victoria Beckham does this and she got this lean in 3 weeks after the baby. I want to be like that. It's like, you know, it's not realistic.
The stress alone from like somebody looking onto that type of thing is massive. And again, it's a misconception that people on Instagram and social media look to be having the perfect life when inside they don't really anyway.
Yeah, and that's one thing we try to get across with every single client is goal setting, as we talked about, the GTI principle. When a client comes into you, they need to have a goal. Now, I'm not going to say I don't want you to have this aspiration to look with that because that's not feasible, but you need your clients to have a realistic goal that they can actually achieve. And you need to educate them on that, you know, and they need to be educated on it, you know.
Yeah.
When clients come to me, we call it the bridging model. When they come into you now, I say, what do you want to look like, what do you want to feel like, can you remember a time in your life that you were in a good shape? Oh, was that day I got married, or was that honeymoon, or whatever it may be. Well, picture yourself then and picture yourself now, and what's the difference between them, and what can you do to get back there? Now, we can't turn back the clock, we'd like to do that, but unfortunately some people never get in that shape again. Isn't realistic about it, you know.
So
it's a more realistic goal than looking like Victoria Beckham, you know, which a lot of people have in their heads. And again, I'm going back to a book here, citing a book, but they were saying about even asking Olympic athletes, or an athlete, it was varsity athletes actually, run 200 metres in 10 seconds. So they basically set the athletes this challenge: you're going to run 200 metres in 10 seconds. Clearly in their heads they're going, fuck, that's impossible, like, I can't do that. So what they actually did was time, or actually see what distance they could run. So they ran 59 metres. They set it at 100 metres and they were able to run 63 metres, because in their head they started adopting the principles that actually get there. They think, well, fuck, this is an easier task than trying to run 200 metres. So they were able to get further with it, you know, and setting realistic goals is in sure, kind of vein, in that vein. Like,
One of my issues with goals, I think goal setting is phenomenal, but when it comes to goal setting, I don't like when it's too far apart. I like when they have little mini goals, like we call them outcomes, what you want to happen maybe in 2 weeks' time, daily, a weekly action, then daily tasks. People need to be focusing on their goals daily. It just doesn't happen. You need to act. Jack Canfield, I'm sure you read his book, The Success Principles. But you need to act as if you want to be a 70 kilo guy, or a 100 kilo guy, act like that guy. That guy trains. That guy sleeps, that guy looks after his supplements, that guy, you know, is a good person, he manages his stress well. But you have to act as if every day, not every other day, you know?
There's a good part in that book as well too, by James Clear, Atomic Habits, when he talks about that girl that was looking to lose 100 pounds, and she started acting as if she was saying, like, what would I do, or what would a healthy person do in this situation? Would they eat the cream cheese bagel, or would they eat the salad, or would they take a taxi, or would they walk?
What would that size dress girl do in comparison to size 4? You have to be that person. You know?
Just a quick question. We haven't even got to talk about the athletes you've trained. I know you went over to Azerbaijan and trained the Olympic wrestling team. What do you see is the difference in mindset between, like, an athlete and, you know, your general pop? Or personality, or what is different? What makes them, sets them apart?
Like, Charles had a great quote about athletes. He says, athletes, if you say to them, I want you to run into the wall, the only thing they'll say is, how many sets, how many reps? they will just do it, because they're doing it for a set goal, to get a gold medal, to get obviously the gold medal, to get a UFC belt, to get the World Cup, whatever it may be. Their focus is very different. They live and breathe it, which I think is sometimes hard, because I've got a few guys that are transitioning out of sport now into the latter part of life. And what do they do after? There's no rugby, or what they do after? There's no UFC, so it's difficult for them. But I think athletes are just a bit more driven, a bit more focused, a bit more, they're willing to do more extremes. You know, they're willing to live that life a bit more, because it is their life. Like, if your only thing to do is train 2-3 times a day, like in Azerbaijan, it was funny, it's a weird country, it's very wealthy, like, it's silly wealthy, like, it's like Dubai. So I turned up to what's called the Gafas is Azerbaijani for their headquarters. It was a Hilton hotel, with the Hilton hotel sign taken down. Now, I know that because there was remnants of it still on the hotel. So they all lived in this hotel and got food in the top. And then we go training 3 times a day in the coach. It was silly. But that's all they did. They trained, eat, slept, trained constantly.
Nothing outside.
Yeah. Nothing.
What was that like? What was that like for an experience for you as a coach?
I had a good guy called Mark Filippi. He's actually a strong man. You look him up. He was there with me. Great guy. But the language barrier was difficult. As I said yesterday, every single guy and girl had one eyebrow, just one unibrow right across the back. But it was difficult. The language barrier was confusing. It was hard to coach. So what I would use a lot of is I would use
Gillette on their eyebrows.
I didn't go near that. And it's funny, they'd hold hands and all and kiss and all. Like, not from it.
Did you get involved in that?
No, I didn't get involved in any of that. But it was.
What would the odds be in that?
But they would. I used to use an app called UberSense, and I would video the guys doing exercises, and I could put lines in about where their angles are, where the depth was. Obviously, you could use your hands for the repetitions. I would do a lot of programming on the whiteboard, and the nutrition. Like, when you're trying to talk nutrition and macros and calories and supplements with guys, you don't speak the language. Your Pictionary skills and your charade skills get pretty, and the translator hadn't got a Billy Ocean. What, like two a day? Well, God, sure he was. but yeah, it was a challenge. And like you make things simple very easy. So I had let's say I had guys getting into the weight class. So we had ABC. So I set a big chart in the canteen. So A was at your weight. B was you were putting on weight, and C was you're cutting weight.
Yeah.
So it was very straightforward, you know. So, but these guys had to understand that. But what did that mean? So underneath each one of the categories, they had foods they could and couldn't eat.
Yeah.
So you had to make it simple, and you had to make it relatable. And then you were going around doing their body composition or hydration or making their shakes. Actually, one of the guys, he won a gold medal in 2012, I think it was in London, and he was the big star. He was a big star. So he comes to me, and he comes with one of the performers director says, "Oh, you want some more of a kick during training? Did I have anything that could help him?" So I said, "I have beta-alanine," and I tried to explain to him that beta-alanine would cause tingles, but he didn't get it. So you just see him wrestling, and he's trying to explain to me at Azerbaijani that he was tripping off beta-alanine. But
it happened to you one weekend, man.
Were you up for that?
I was there.
Yeah. Remember?
You were speaking?
I do remember that. You can tell it.
So we were teaching a hypertrophy course.
I think it was.
And Owen doesn't deal quite well with 2 grams of beta-alanine. So we have the Ballygown released this new sparkling water, some flavoured shit. So you wouldn't see anything in it because it was in a can. So I says, "Owen, do you want a Ballygown?" Yeah, Grant. So he went to the toilet, and me and the lads put 15 grams of beta-alanine in it. So like he's up teaching, and me, Stephen and Robbie are sitting at the back, and he's like going, you can see sweat dropping from his head. He's
trying to get all fidgety.
He's moving back and forward quicker, and then like he's like, "We're just going to go down to do the workout. We'll do the workout, and we'll come back in an hour." And he goes down to Stephen. He's like, "I feel a bit fucking weird, like, you know, I feel a bit tingly. I can't stay easy." And then Stephen told him what it was. So 15 grams.
My nipples were going crazy. I remember just going, "What the fuck is going on?" And then you guys were talking in the back of the room. I was like, "Hey lads, professional, what are you talking for?"
"Hi, professional." "Professional."
I moved myself off.
See, the Azerbaijan, was it 2 years? Was it
2 years? Yeah.
2 years. And what way did that work out? You go fly over, stay over for a certain amount of days, come back?
Yeah, I generally would go over for a week every month.
Right.
So we'll go over, do nutrition, do the programs with Mark, train the guys up on it, do all the body composition, hydration, get their blood results, give the recommendations, and then come back.
Yeah.
And then go to and from.
And you get what, 9 Olympic medals at that, wasn't it?
No,
yeah, you actually hold that record in Ireland. For S&C coach?
I don't think I even looked that up until you were asking me about stuff. Yeah. So I looked it up. No other coaches ever got 9
Olympic medals. Yeah. Brilliant. So what do you actually prefer yourself? Do you actually prefer working with athletes more, or kind of general pop?
I'll be honest, a general pop, I think I get much more satisfaction from helping people. Like people from a digestive point of view, from a skin point of view, from a health point of view. I make a joke saying that women cry in my office, but they cry all the time.
Yeah.
All the time. There's tissues on the table. But they're just fed up and not getting results. Mm-hmm. So I like being able to help people piece things together that they haven't been done before.
It's a harder job as well too. Yeah. As you say, like an athlete, you tell them what they do, they're going to do it.
Yeah.
General pop is a whole different ball game. Yeah. You're playing into a lot of different things there to try and get people to actually do what you're asking them to do.
Yeah, like I've sat down with some really high level rugby guys one to one and gone through their nutrition, and they're like, "Oh, no one's ever," like I'd be asking them mad questions, like you know the sort of questions I ask, and they're going, "No one's ever asked me this." And these guys are playing rugby years. These are sports people playing. Like I had sprinters and high jumpers and all sorts come and see me, and they're like, "Oh, no one's ever asked me that question before."
Yeah.
Ever. So the problem is people aren't getting in deep into the information. Yeah. So I think there's definitely, it'll change over the next one. Nutrition and performance and training will change massively.
Yeah, brilliant.
And that's obviously why people are attracted to ISI, is because you do get deep.
Yeah.
Like it's people that have tried shit in the past, I'm sure, and failed numerous times with the same kind of questions being asked by their trainers. And that's obviously the people that's coming to you, I'm assuming.
Well, what happens is, I've tried so many ways and they haven't worked. So when I was in this big Westwood gym training so many people, like you've 10,500 members, fitness classes, for example, we had this thing called Les Mills. So my girlfriend, that's not important. That's good.
Your girlfriend?
At the time. Okay, let's go.
Cut out the at the time part.
Classes, people would go to classes all the time. Like, and it's been shown that if you go to if you go to fitness classes in a commercial gym, you will stay a member of that gym for longer. 100% fact. Yeah. That if you're going to fitness classes because of the community, yeah. people like that community. Oh, how are you doing, Agnes? Welcome back to the class. How are you, yeah. Mary? How are you, Anne? It's a setup. It's a community that you're missed if you're not there. However, if you're just going as a general, you know, average gym goer, our use is 1.2 times a week.
Yeah.
So that's like minimal. People make more money out of people not going to commercial gyms than going to them.
Yeah.
So I realized that wasn't for me. So the more you deal with people on a one-to-one basis, the more things don't work. Like, we cut calories, didn't work for this person. Cut calories, didn't work for this person. This person's on a ketogenic style diet. This person's on a high carb diet or low carb diet. So just different approaches need to work. And that's how we, I suppose, we got skilled with different techniques, because you need to have different tools in your toolbox.
Yeah.
It can't, if all you have is a hammer, as you know, everything's a nail. So you need to have different approaches. And it's approach for that client at that time in their life that they're willing to do it, you know?
Yeah, as like you kind of mentioned yesterday, maybe that's why you don't go down, maybe the small group even set, and you try and keep it one-to-one because of that specialist attention that you like to give people.
Yeah, and you know what? I think the model works. I think it can be very effective, but I think you need to be an exceptional coach. So Dan Baker, we were, Adam and Robbie are running a powerlifting program for the clients, and one of the reasons why they're doing it is clients like to do powerlifting, they like to work on a technique, but they like to have a goal, something to train towards.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they do in the program is not everyone will lift at the same time, so you can go over the group, but coaching a big group, particularly with its heavy weights, and now gyms, like we were talking about black box earlier on, when you design a gym like a lot of black box gyms, there's a lot more free weights, there's a lot more functional training, which means there has to be more attention to detail. When you get on a bench press, it's forward and back or left and right. You have to be a moron not to be able to use it.
Yeah.
But when you go to a squat rack, look, what can be done? Anything. Mm. But the injury risk goes up.
Yeah.
So with the more versatility of these gyms, the more compliance and training needs to be there. So like doing a normal fitness course and coming out and then going into a gym that you can, like, the multitude of exercises is huge. Yeah. I remember going to a gym for Life Fitness, and I went through all the machines that the girl had sold to this guy. And then he comes to the dumbbell rack and he says, okay, so what can we do here? And I looked at him and went, what sort of question is that? Like, what can I do with these dumbbells? I'm like, going, have you got 10 years? Like, well, like what sort of question is that? So people, when you have a gym, like big rigs and big dumbbells, and it's unlimited.
Yeah.
Which means your quality control, your what we call it, exercise, this benefit to safe ratio.
Mm.
So yes, it's a beneficial exercise, but the risk is too high for that client. You know?
I think that's where like proper programming does come in, where you need to actually spend the time on the program. And then like what we do with the coaches, we'll go through the programs before our members even see them. So a month ahead, we'll go through the programs and we actually sit down and go, this is how it should work. If you come up against this, this is what you should do. How the session should flow exactly. So the guys know exactly what way it's going to operate.
Yeah.
Kind of for nearly each individual member that we have. So when it does come the time for the next program, they're already well schooled on it and they know how it's flowing.
Yeah. You know, I think the great system. And even yesterday we spoke with a warm-up. So many people skip the warm-up.
Yeah.
You see people walk into the bar, and Adam had a client, I think he nearly killed him one day. He came in and jumped onto the chin-up bar. Oh, I'm going to see how my shoulder feels, and do a chin-up. Like, no, nearly killed him.
Yeah.
So you have to, like, this warm-up business, people are not doing it enough justice. They're not doing the mobility only when they hurt themselves.
Yeah.
So I think programming, when it comes to big movements, people need to be more trained, more comfortable, you know? Even like a trap bar deadlift.
Yeah.
A trap bar deadlift is a much safer way to deadlift than a straight bar, everyone thinks. However, the problem is the higher risk, and this has been done by the NSCA, when you do a deadlift from the floor, the risk of injury is higher from the floor up towards your knee. That's the big risk area.
Right.
However, the risk of a trap bar, it tends to be from the knee to the hip, because it's not against your body, so it can swing when you're in a high position. But a lot of people say, oh, let's just trap bar them, it's easier to do.
Mm.
It's still a compound move, it's a big movement. Yeah. You can lift a lot of weight.
Overload it.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
And the handles are elevated off the ground, so you can lift much more weight.
Yeah.
So there you have a client that is not strong enough to do a proper deadlift.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that they should do an like, I don't mind, you know, progressing them slowly.
Mm. Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is people are putting too heavy weights on these on these core movements, because they can do them.
They can do them.
You know, not one sweep gives you a cavity, you know, so it wears on you.
Mm. I think I actually never thought about that. The black box setup is becoming more and more popular.
Yeah.
And that means that there's going to be less and less machines that are controlling posture, control movement. Like there's chest presses are kind of done away with, even treadmills and stuff. Yeah. Obviously, cardio equipment's going down, but it means that the, you know, the stabilizing muscles and core and mobility, as you say, that has to go up. Like our knowledge of that has to go up because we can't stick someone in a fucking chest press now and just say, you know, do 10 reps. There's nowhere else they can go.
You do need to be a better. You do need to be a better coach.
You need to understand a lot more.
Better technician. We were going to go by Gregory's place and get some stuff in the way. Boy, I think Gregory's equipment is phenomenal. But then you look at the tracks. Yeah. You have a rig and then you have a track. Mm-hmm. So we have this stuff, and you see it all the time where people talk about tempo and reps and sets and work to rest ratio and time under tension and total session time and total work time and exercise order, exercise sequence, contraction type, all this real high scientific stuff. And they do all that. And then they go to the fitness stuff and say, they just go crazy. Hang on a second. You've just structured a perfect program and then you've just done random shit at the end.
Yeah.
Like, it has to be continuous, you know, it has to have some continuum of stimulus for the body. But when it comes to the energy systems, people just go crazy. I'm just going to get a sweat going. I just want to get moving. Like sled stuff, for example, and we do this at the seminars. We didn't do it yesterday, but I ask a room of people, what do you do for energy systems at the end? I do mountain climbers, squat jumps, lunges, push a sled, drag a sled, bike, row. Okay, wall sit. So what do they all have in common? Quad.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't write a program like that.
Yeah.
You wouldn't write an imbalanced program, but you'll do energy systems like that.
Yeah.
So you have to look at the prescription. You have to look at, yes, it's great to have a track in the gym. It's great to have a rig in the gym. But with that freedom of a track, with that freedom of a rig, comes more focus. I was going to do a Spider-Man quote there. you need more knowledge on how to apply it for your clients.
Yeah.
And safety. I see nobody using the pins, nobody using the J-hooks to support a client. Safety first. I always show a client how to throw a bar off their back. If you've got bumper plates, you spent the money on bumper plates, show your client how to drop a bar, you know?
Or you've got six guys in the gym and they're all squatting and the coach is actually on the phone Instagramming it. Which is just fucking ridiculous.
Phone usage in a gym is a cardinal sin. I don't mind using it sometimes for heart rate. I'd rather use my iPad, but stuff like that, no.
An exercise like that where there's a big risk of injury.
Yeah.
And you're following it.
The only time I would try and follow my client is if her or his posture was like, and they can't see it. You know, you're trying to tell someone, listen, you've got to retract your shoulder blades or, you know, get into a certain position, and they just can't visualize it. So you have to kind of go, well, here's what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, and apart from
that's different.
Yeah.
Because you're coaching them. You're coaching them through the exercise and you're giving them the teaching points.
And then sometimes in the changing rooms.
Well, that's
the GoPro
special attention.
Right, so we put up on the Instagram and Facebook as well too, for questions on just a few guys sent in questions that they want answered basically, and we had a few questions even from yesterday in the seminar that people didn't get get covered. So one of the ones that came in was where is it? Causes of night sweats for women. Is there a specific cause or what do you feel that's going on?
Okay, so initially if someone's having night sweats.
Yeah, I'm in the room.
Yeah, standing looking in the window.
You got a sweaty man on top of you. That's probably one of the reasons. Night sweat at night time, I would look at cortisol issues is the first thing I would look at. So I would probably look into asking some questions about dizziness when standing, what their level of energy is like during the day. Blood sugar, I would definitely check in particular. If people aren't remembering their dreams or they're having very, very vivid dreams, it's a good chance that they're B6 deficient. So vivid dreams or not remembering the dreams at all is very highly correlated to B6. So I'd address that. Blood sugar, cortisol and B6 would be my go-to. Is it a male or a female?
That's female. Women, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I'd obviously ask questions about their cycle, hydration levels and magnesium.
You know? Yeah. Just have to pill.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. There's a thing called pyrrole deficiency, which causes the body to actually use up more B6, zinc and vitamin C. I'd ask those questions too.
Right. There was another one. Does strength training, fat loss, nutrition change at all for women as they get older, or should it?
100% does. So again, as I said yesterday, women don't have testicles, so they don't have the same level of ability to make testosterone that we do. So we have to make sure that we're optimizing their hormonal cascade, if you like, during the transition. I don't feel that women, as they get older, need to do as much aerobic exercise. Aerobic exercise is in itself, can be beneficial for the heart, obviously in the lungs. But the day you stop doing cardio, and I want to say this very slowly, the day you stop doing cardio is the day you die. So just because you're lifting weights doesn't mean you're not doing cardio. You're still getting your heart rate up, but it's just not sustained at a low level for a long period of time. So I would probably reduce down the amount of long steady state cardio they're doing, do more resistance training, and I might do more isometric holds, I might do more eccentric stuff to maintain bone density, maintain ligament support, and get range of motion.
Yeah, brilliant. Yep. Another one was, what changes would you make when a client plateaus without having the lower calories? So there's a lot of...
So what I would do there is, we have a little system that we'd like to follow. So we might do intermittent fasting, AM, where we would skip... Now, I heard recently people are saying, don't call it intermittent fasting. But anyway, so I do intermittent fasting, maybe lunch and a dinner for maybe 2 weeks. And what I normally do on that cycle, I do Monday to Saturday. So 6 days of intermittent fasting, one day where you have their breakfast with their family, whatever it is. I do that for 2 weeks. The next 2 weeks, I might do intermittent fasting, skipping the dinner. So having breakfast and lunch for 2 weeks, taking one day off. And then the next 2 weeks, I might do what's called time-restricted feeding. Ideally, Dr. Panda, the best research is 12 to 4. Is where you get that window, but we might move it around, and with those alterations we see what people can manage, how to maintain their blood sugar levels.
Is that not lower in calories, or is the rest of the calories in the other meals the same?
Other calories, we're getting all the calories in, we're just having that. The whole benefit of intermittent fasting is it prolongs the fast, it improves your blood regulatory systems, and you have autophagy, or the turnover of cells, much faster. So it's beneficial, it makes you a better fat burner. Plus, Adam has you say it better than me, but when you see a straight line in anywhere, particularly in a hospital, it's not a good sign. No, so you want things to be fluctuating up and down, and you want things to be doable. So when I say to clients, if you have a night off, on let's say you had a drink or had a wine, skip breakfast the next day, then go for a walk. So give your client tools that they can fluctuate things. Dr. Jay Tita, he has a system on metabolism. It's called Eat More. So most people will eat less and exercise more. But the problem is, there's so many other ways to do that. We could actually eat less and move less. We could eat more, exercise more if you're trying to put on weight. So there's loads of different ways to stimulate the metabolism. But just eating less and training more is just one stimulus. We need to fluctuate it.
What was the question again?
So what changes would you make in terms of a client's plateau without having the lower calories? So again, you could look into a lot of different things like sleep and recovery in general.
When I was over on my first internship with Dr. Serrano, and Owen mentioned it there, like when you go to hospital and you see a flat line, that you're no longer responding. So if you've got a flat line of calories, 1500 1500 1500 1500, your body just adapts. And sometimes you need to go higher and sometimes you need to go lower. But then they've just used the word calories in that question. Macros. You've got to waive your protein, you've got to waive your fat, you've got to waive your carbohydrate. So you can still stick on the calorie basis, but you can change all of the macros around every single day. You can change, like I mentioned, you can manipulate your meals from breakfast to evening and get totally different results based on the same thing. But like I said, I wouldn't let anything stagnate. Like, so for a lot of my clients, I let them go until they stop getting results. And then I say, right, now we need to change something. And if that's eating more protein or eating more carbohydrates, it all depends on who
they
are. But
as you say yesterday too, even the sources, changing the sources. Right, a lot of people, they get into their heads, okay, it's the chicken turkey.
It's terrible. And then the thermogenic effect of food, of protein and fat, is higher, obviously. And then if you're going to increase someone's NEAT, maybe you're going to do that.
I would say that when we talk about stagnation, when we talk about, the results kind of flatlining, I've seen people after 2 days, if they flatline, they need to change it up, you know what I mean? So it's kind of, I suppose, putting it into perspective that this happens through time. Like, this is over a period of probably a couple of weeks, I'm sure, if we see no change, so people know that.
Another question was, I think you actually brought it up yesterday too, getting clients to understand just because you aren't sweating in the gym doesn't mean that you're not getting results. It's a big misconception, isn't it, that a person thinks that if they're not sweating and they're not breathing out their ass, that they're not getting a productive workout.
You know what? It's a double-edged sword there. Clients feel that they need to sweat. So if a client comes to you and they're looking for fat loss and they haven't sweat in the session, you can modulate things towards the end of the session to get them to sweat so they feel like they've done some work. But you don't necessarily need to sweat. Plus, there's a certain section of the population that don't sweat that well, and that's another issue altogether. So
Well, I think the way you have to look at it is,
lazy people like me.
I don't mean
never sweat.
But I think the way you have to look at it is, there are clients that do go to these classes that are mainly like heated up rooms, and they are sweating, and they're not getting results. You're getting it from both directions. I'm sweating a lot. I'm always out of breath. I go balls to floor in the gym. But I'm not getting results. Why? So it helps for some people and it doesn't for others.
We're back to the sauna suits.
So another one was, what is the recommended dose for carnitine for women?
Will we break down even the carnitine?
So,
and why would they have carnitine?
Yeah. Okay, yeah, so we were speaking yesterday about beta oxidation. Beta oxidation is the fancy word for saying when you take fat inside your cell, inside the mitochondria in particular, to oxidize it, to burn it. So it's basically burning fat. And the transporter, there's actually two transporters, what's called acetylcarnitine transferase 1 and acetylcarnitine 2. So carnitine basically just brings it inside the factory. So if you're deficient in carnitine, you're not going to be able to burn fat efficiently. Now, we can make carnitine. Everyone can make carnitine. However, there's a gene in the body called the MTHFR gene. I'm sure people have heard it before. Yeah, the motherfucker gene. So the methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase gene. And if you have that gene, you don't make carnitine. Well, a lot of people are not eating carnitine in their diet, so then they're inefficient fat burners. So in order for you to help your client burn fat, to give them more energy, I would add carnitine in. Ultimately, I would like them to have red meat maybe twice a week. But carnitine, we generally supplement it in the morning for a woman, about 1.2 to 1.5 grams.
1.5.
So not that much. For a man, I go much higher. High levels of carnitine, though, and some people actually use injectable carnitine. I don't necessarily recommend that. But high levels of carnitine for a long time can slow down your thyroid. Anything above 5 grams. So I like to keep it below 3. For a woman, I generally use it in the morning. For men, I have it in divided dosages.
Pre-training?
Pre-training. I like it with coffee in the morning, or maybe with free forms. It's and quite good.
Would they cycle that? Would there be a period of time on, period of time off, or would you just be continuous?
Yeah, I like to use it as it gets you pre-workout. It's quite good for energy.
Yeah.
But I always like to cycle things.
Yeah.
So I like to say to people, big dose, short time, low dose, long time. So if you're taking something, it's not like it. I don't want to say that. So if you're going to take a high level of something for a stimulus, it's good to come on and off. It gives you more, you're more reactive to it, you're more sensitive to it.
Yeah.
So and maybe a month on.
We talked a wee bit about blends yesterday. Does it matter?
Yeah, so Beverly International, they probably have the best product. It's called QuadraCarn. So basically four different forms of carnitine. Acetyl L-carnitine is probably the most absorbable. You can get L-carnitine, which is quite good. Carnitine on its own, which is only okay. So ALC, or acetyl-carnitine, L-carnitine, carnitine propionate is quite good. And for guys wanting to boost their testosterone, carnitine tartrate is quite good.
Yeah, so say for the average person that's looking to kind of make an impact on like their overall health in terms of vitamins, minerals and getting, what would be your go-to? So for Joe Bloggs, who just wants to try and improve their health?
B vitamins, straight away.
Yeah.
B vitamins, every single time I do a blood test, B vitamins are low. We spoke yesterday about if you need to deliver stuff around dairy, you wouldn't want to deliver it in a mini, you wouldn't want it in an articulated lorry, you'd like it in a transit van. You can stock it and get everywhere around the city. The problem is people's hemoglobin and their cell size are all over the place. And what regulates your cell size and your ability of your cell to carry oxygen and hemoglobin around the body is largely down to B vitamin status. So guys are not eating enough green veg, they're not eating salads, they're not digesting this food, and they're every time they come back with low B9, B12, iron, six. Copper, you know, so B6 in particular, yeah? So I would do that, and this is the thing, there's one B vitamin called riboflavin, B2, that when you go to the bathroom and when you piss, it'll look like it's fluorescent, luminous. It doesn't mean you're weeing out your B vitamins. So people say, oh, I'm pissing it out. You have no problem having an expensive bottle of wine and pissing that out. You give out a bit of multivitamin, you know?
I can't
understand it. So don't worry if your wee is a little bit darker. That's just the riboflavin coming out. It's not that you're dehydrated. So don't be stressing about that. So B-complex straight off the bat.
Yeah.
Straight off the bat. Will be my
I think to highlight on vitamins, though, because especially I recommended a client to go and get a B-complex there the other day, and she sent back a my protein one.
Yeah.
And I think the importance of knowing what vitamins you're buying, because when I was first in the industry, that was something I was like, oh, well, they look like they're the same readings. But then, again, spend time with Owen or Eric and even Robbie, you're learning that, they're, you know, it's like getting a car without the fucking wheels on it.
Yeah.
It doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, so when you do buy a B complex from my protein, it's not exactly usable. So now you have to then put your body through more methylation things eventually to get that to having wheels, having an engine and a steering wheel and so get going.
It's about the active ingredient. Yeah. So how much is actually in it?
Exactly. A lot of times, you know, you're taking a gram, how much of you actually getting by the time it's all converted?
Yeah.
You know, so like looking for pharmaceutical brands, making sure they're getting good quality ones rather than these supplement brands, because any numpty can make a fucking tablet.
Just on that, and this is completely off topic, but that gene I talked about, so we all have these genes in our body, and this gene is what's called a SNP, and it stands for single nucleotide polymorphism. It basically just means that we don't absorb B vitamins that well, particularly folic acid or B9. So what's going to happen is we have this gene called the MTHFR gene, and a lot of that, 70% of that gene, goes towards making creatine in the body for cell energy. So if you think you have this gene, By taking 5 grams of creatine, you massively help your methylation system, massively. Yeah. So it's the cheapest, easiest way to help someone that has that defect. And if you want to look at more into that or even get your genes tested, Dr. Ben Lynch is the expert. Dr. Ben Lynch has all the research on that. But 46% of Irish people have that. Mm. Cleft palate, alcoholism, bipolar, schizophrenia, anxiety issues.
Depression.
Yeah, depression, massive. So it's very interesting, guys, if anyone has that, to look it up, Dr. Ben Lynch, the MTHFR gene.
Yeah, what about vitamin D?
Vitamin D is basically going to be very low. We don't get enough sunlight.
Yeah.
You should not take vitamin D without vitamin K with it.
Right.
So we like to, what we recommend is a whole spectrum, vitamin A, D, E and K,
yeah,
to get all the fat soluble vitamins.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there a recommendation that you would have for it?
Normally most people recommend between 2 and 5,000 IUs of vitamin D. And what we like to do is we like to have a minimum of 2,000 IUs with vitamin K with it.
Because again, it's kind of, it's a problem too, that a lot of people don't absorb it properly as well, don't they?
We spoke yesterday about the gallbladder. So the gallbladder is where you store your bile. Bile is, what bile will do is, and this is interesting, bile will break down fats, allow you to absorb your fats or emulsify your fats, as they say, allow you to absorb your fat soluble vitamins. But bile does something that people don't realise. What it does is it's a detergent. So you have a small intestine and a large intestine, and the small intestine has X amount of bacteria and the large intestine has X amount of bacteria. The small intestine bacteria should stay where it is and the large intestine bacteria should stay where it is. If the large intestine bacteria moves up to the small intestine, it's called SIBO, small intestinal bacteria overgrowth. And then people get wind, bloating, belching and gassing.
Yeah.
And the big sign of that is swelling below the belly button. A lot of women have it. But if you've got good bile, bile just keeps everything where it should be. It's like a bouncer for the small and large intestine. But if you've got low bile, these guys creep in to the small intestine.
Yeah.
It's really common for women. Belching, burping. You can get a breath test, but there's loads of things you can do to help.
Said that right. We were doing a consultation once and somebody had SIBO. Well, we were testing for SIBO and Owen's talking to her and I'm sitting in on the consultation and he's like, yeah, so we need to do a breast test. And so I'm like, oh no, I don't think we do. No, we do. And so can you organise a breast test for her? And I was like, breath test. Yeah, breast test. And I was like,
you know what I'm like with boobs, dude. I
hope she's not listening, but she didn't have any, so like, you know.
I remember that day. And I kept saying, what's the problem?
So what am I saying? Breast.
Yeah, like a couple of people mentioned yesterday that they had clients that were, their gallbladder was removed. And what was the approach? What is the approach? So if a client, a PT, is working out there with a girl who has had their gallbladder removed, what should they initially do in the start off for that person nutritionally?
So your ability to digest fats is going to be compromised. Now, your liver makes bile, your gallbladder doesn't make bile necessarily, it more stores it. So what I would do is I would control the fat intake, first of all, and monitor the symptoms, how they feel. I would take digestive enzymes, particularly with ox bile in it. So your digestive enzyme must have ox bile in it. And if you wanted, you could add in apple cider vinegar before your meal. That's also really good to help to prime the digestive system for it, and chew your food as much as you can.
Yeah.
People swallow food when they can get it down their gob. They don't swallow it when they've broken it down as small as they can. The goal of chewing food in your mouth, so what you want to do, you want to chew the food, first of all, break it down, increase the surface area, get as much salivary amylase on your food, so you make a better surface area for your stomach to churn it around with hydrochloric acid and an intrinsic factor. But we need boil to help break down the fats, eat a bit slower, and apple cider vinegar is a great
one. Yeah, you know, I think a good tip that Adam brought up yesterday was for people that are doing that, even making their food, so they are putting herbs and spices and stuff on their food, where they do actually salivate before they vet their food, so it helps in the whole process.
It activates receptors, it's really good, you know?
Yeah.
Also, we have a t-shirt that says 5, 10, 50 and 20 on it. And what it basically stands for is to have 5 diaphragmatic breaths before you have a meal. So if I was here with Dr. Serrano, he would say, pray, I'm not that way inclined, but 5 belly breaths activate the vagus nerve, gets the diaphragm activated, and it gets you into a more rest and digest state. So it's very good. Then every 10 seconds, put the knife and fork down, allow you to chew your food a bit more. Your meal should last at least 15 minutes. If your meal doesn't last 15 minutes, you're not going to get that feedback that you're satisfied and you can overeat quite easy.
Yeah.
And then 20-minute walk. A 20-minute walk after a meal. So what I like to think about is when you put food into your factory to digest it, it's going to be a little bit of inflammation afterwards. By taking a walk, you liberate and you break down any sugars that have been liberated into your bloodstream. Yeah. You digest better and it's good for gravity.
Is that for like GLUT4?
Exactly, glutathioreceptors and just and gravity for this.
Yeah,
I would be probably finished my dinner by the time you do your five breaths. On
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
I actually, it's one, of, yeah, it's one of my things, and that's I think that's common amongst a lot of people in Ireland.
It's really common, you know.
But even in our industry, everybody's eating on the passenger seat of their car, behind the reception desk.
Life's busy now, like much busier than what it was, and that's.
I don't think it's busy, but I think that it's convenient. It's everything is convenient. You can go and grab whatever it is you want and eat it on the go, where like before that just wasn't available, where people did sit down and eat their meals and maybe chew their food a wee bit longer.
Yeah. And this thing about being on a screen, when you have your food, you shouldn't be on a screen. When you have a meal, if you can at home with your family, have a conversation. Yeah. Heaven forbid my wife put her phone down for a second. So again, it's not about being in front of the screen, eating your food and being in the moment. It's so important.
Yeah.
And food in front of the television and holding food, generally, not always, but generally food that you hold in your hand is not always good food. Burgers, crisps, sweets, bars, you know, it's not good food, you know. So.
But I think that highlights another thing for the industry. Like, you know, if you are in the industry and you are that busy and your clients see you eating at the reception desk, they see, like, they sometimes nearly feel bad. Oh, go on, take your time. It's like, it's their time. Like, you know, so, like, I once had a client and she used to always do 5:30 in the morning, and then she left her job and she was like, right, I can do 10:30 or 11:30. I'd say, well, I'll do whatever. Well, if I come in at 10:30, how many clients am I in a row? You'll be 4 or 5. No, you go get breakfast. You're not the same person.
Yeah.
And she was right. Like, you know, like if I had done it, like, you know, but she'd be the 4th client in a row and I probably wouldn't be the same person.
Yeah.
So, you know, and they feel that in the service. And somebody did say it the other day that they gave the 5th session was their best session or something like that.
Yeah.
And the other 4, you just wasn't switched on for that. Like, you know, clients deserve a good service. Like.
Of course.
Definitely. And that's a common thing, isn't it? That we all do, or we all have done, where we just like work from 6 o'clock in the morning straight through to lunch, don't take a break. Go home, fall asleep, come back and do the same again in the evening.
Yeah.
All over.
You know what?
Every day.
At one point, not now, but at one point I had more trainer clients than I had normal clients, if that makes sense. So a lot of guys had their own gyms and their trainers were coming to me for nutrition, for training. And I'm going to include myself, and I might include you, Seamus, in it to a small degree. We are absolutely hypocrites. We are such hypocrites because we're telling people to look after themselves, sit down, have their food, get good sleep, get good rest. And then we're burning ourselves out. Like, literally, I've done more adrenal stress profiles and adrenal tests on trainers. I used to include it in the courses because I thought it was that important. And only one guy ever was decent. He was a basketball chilled out guy, whatever. But people are burning themselves out.
Yeah.
And then you asked the question yesterday at the seminar. What do we put us at in terms of health? And everyone was around the kind of 3 mark because we were scared.
Nobody. But is this the thing?
By the end of the seminar, it changed. The 3 minutes where they
were minus. A couple of boys were in the minus. They had a scale of 1 to 5, and they were minus 6.
We're here telling people to invest in their health, and then we're eating from Tupperware containers in between sessions. What's that about? You know.
Yeah.
And you're right. You're not the same person.
No.
If you're doing that many sessions in a row, you're not going to give the best service. Is it going to be an excellent service? No. So it's one of those things we have to, it sounds silly, Damien Maher said it to me once on the airplane. They say put your own mask on first. You need to look after yourself.
That's right.
So whether you're a dad or you're an employer or a trainer or a player on a football pitch, you need to look after yourself. You have so many different roles in your job as a son, as a father, as an employer. So you have to.
Yeah.
You have to be there. You know?
Is there a gap or something that you maybe see in the industry? Is there something that you think that the industry is different from maybe when you started back maybe 20 odd years ago in terms of how personal trainers are performing or how personal trainers are in their own business? Is it an educational gap, or do you feel that there's something that kind of needs to be addressed and fixed within the fitness industry as a whole?
Yeah, so it's funny. So my next door neighbour, she knocked into my house. She says, oh, you work in the gym, don't you? I said, Linda, yeah, I do. I work in the gym. My son's interested in doing it. Could you talk to him? So I'm like, okay, no problem. So we'll go over and talk to this fella. He's 20. He actually enrolled in a Santa College course. Have you seen that course?
Yeah.
It's actually not bad. Like, you know, Liam Hennessy and Noel One, and they're switched on guys. But anyway, this guy said, I want to get into the fitness industry, and I follow all these people. So I'm going, well, what books have you read? And I follow this guy on Instagram and this guy on Facebook.
I'm going to say that.
The people you're not around these people. So this is going to sound corny, but when I was, what age was I? Well, it must have been, maybe I was 13 or 14, and I said to my dad, I want a weight set. I want a weight set. He said, okay, well, where are you going to get it from? Argus. And there was only one Argus in Ireland at the time. It was up here in Belfast. So we drove up,
Yeah.
And I bought this set of weights, and I had them in the gym, had them in my shed, and I used to lift them the whole time. And I used to write
prison curls.
And I used to write letters to Waiter in York for programs and stuff to stick on the wall. I'm fucking corny, I know it is. I still have them at home. So I'd have these sets in, pictures in the wall. So Waiter and York and all these magazines, and I'd be looking up these guys. Unfortunately, the people that these young trainers are seeing aren't necessarily experts or established professionals in the field.
Yeah.
They're people that are glamorized on social media. Well, I'm not slagging anybody off, but you go and look at The Rock having a big cheat meal. Like Dwayne Johnson, nice guy, has a good message, but he's on steroids. Let's call it spade a spade. He was once called a pebble, now he's a rock. He's mad. So you have to know this, but these kids don't know that. So
yeah.
I think, from like, you wanted to be an electrician, you have to do an apprenticeship. You have to be in work with other professionals to get your craft. And then like Adam and Robbie, they're phenomenal guys, and they're going to be much better than me. Well, thank you. No, but they're the new stage. These guys are growing and they're learning, and Adam works really hard. He's very good in the business side of things and very good in the study, so he knows where he needs to go. But other people, they're on their own. They're getting subjected, and they're average. We all know the average of 5 people we spend the most time with.
Yeah.
But if your people you spend time with are see are on Instagram, and they're not necessarily busy trainers.
No.
And we see these guys, they're not busy. Don't come and tell me how to be a personal trainer. If you haven't got your own gym, you haven't got your own established business. Plus, if you are only a trainer, training someone, you don't have a business. You are your business.
Yeah.
So that's not having a business, that's having clients. Running a business, running a gym, running a team, and you know, training people, looking at your facility. When we walk into any one of my gyms at any point, I try to engage in every single person, not because I want them to know who they are. See, can I help them in any way? Yeah. But unfortunately, young trainers, their circle of exposure, I don't think is broad enough.
No.
But the situation is, I'm not that old, but I was around when the internet started.
Yeah.
Like mobile phones, it's very easy to get good content now.
Mm. Yeah.
Like you wouldn't have to pay for stuff and get a huge amount of content online. But you have to filter it. So try to get not a mentor, I suppose a mentor or someone that could guide you along the journey. Say, look, maybe go to this guy, see what you get. Maybe go to this guy, set it up. Like what you guys did yesterday, bringing us up to present the content to the guys. I'm not saying my way is the best way. It's not. But the very first slide on our presentation was a growth and fixed mindset.
Yeah.
So we want people to go off and learn whatever they want, do whatever they want to do. If they want to do CrossFit, they want to do that and break themselves up, that's okay. They can go and do that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but as you say, like, people aren't doing that. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a lot of personal trainers, especially young trainers, and they aren't doing that. They are following people on Instagram, or they're following.
They have 50,000 followers.
Yeah, exactly. And
they
that's
must know something.
Yeah.
There's a massive amount of information, as you just said. Like, you know, it was, you struggled to get information back in the day. Yeah. You know, whenever the internet exploded, there's more and more getting out of it. It's the filtering process, you're right, that has to be good. That's what you need to be good at, if you can filter out all the shit.
Yeah.
Or take it for what it is, because, you know, these guys are great at business.
Yeah.
You're 50,000 followers, you're good at that. Yeah. You're good at selling yourself.
Yeah, well, not necessarily. You can buy them. And well, that's what a lot of people are doing
that as well.
Yeah, no,
they're buying them.
Stephen, we were promoting the new health summit in May 11th and 12th, and Stephen said, look at his website. So he sends me this screenshot of, you can buy 10,000 followers for $69.
Yeah.
Where was it? I mean, you'll see me tomorrow with 100,000 people following me on Instagram.
And it's funny because we haven't launched it just yet, but we're contemplating doing an apprenticeship.
Yeah.
So not like a mentorship, an apprenticeship, but it won't be me. It'll be Adam and Robbie and Stephen, and every month just do a small workshop, maybe 5 hours, something like we did today, on different aspects. Because a lot of trainers are coming out there, like we spoke about, they're coming out into the industry, they're being thrown into a gym, and not to slag off FlyFit, but in FlyFit they get to be a personal trainer to do a certain amount of shift. There's no someone standing over you.
No.
My first job in that gym, I rocked in a leisure attendant. We had to do skin folds. Right, I was 16, pinching women, which was uncomfortable to say the least. We had to do a fitness test. We had to do a what's called a body stat, like a BMI, hydrostatic weighing. And then we would do measurements and then write the program and then show it to them in an hour.
Yeah.
And we had a guy standing over us the whole time. So it was like a military operation.
Yeah.
So, but they don't get that now. You don't have someone overseeing you. Oh, that's good. What could this be doing? Change this, change that.
There's no assessment.
Yeah. There's no.
Because I remember even like going back to when we did that, I did that internship in Portugal, and Jet and yourself, Robbie, and you were just starting, and your whole thing then was writing loads of programs.
Yeah.
Just practicing how to actually structure and write programs
before
you were actually like on the field, so to speak, actually coaching people. So there's, and that's kind of what's missing. There's no education in terms of that, how do you actually write a program to begin with, and then how do you actually deliver it?
Delivering it, and then regress back to writing it.
And we asked the group yesterday if you wrote your program right there and passed it to the Seamus or to Nola and looked at it and said, well, what's the intention? People don't know.
No.
Like, program writing, exercise prescription, like, you have someone's health in your hands when you're training them. So you need to make sure you know what you're doing, you know what the body's asking to do. It's progressive, it follows they're called principles of training for a reason. But warm up, like, that's the one thing. I'm not saying that people in the room yesterday weren't doing warm ups, but they may step back and go, "Fuck me, there's a lot of reason why you should do warm ups." And not just waste a bit of time at the start.
Gets the blood flowing.
I think one thing from an educational point of view, you asked me and I didn't really have a good answer the first time you asked me, but what helps me, and I've always said this, I think I've learned more from my clients. And that's clients that were getting lower abdominal bloating, and I'd say, right, Owen, can you do a consultation with these, but can I sit in? So like, if you wanted to send somebody down to Owen, you know you could come down and sit in. And I think people are afraid to ask that. If I was coming up to you boys, can I look and have a client coming up, can I just sit in on it? I'll stay in the background, I'll say nothing, it's your baby, you're your client that time, but can I sit in and learn from it, like, you know? Or go and do your own research on it and then go back to them and say, look, this is what I read up, this is what I've come to, whatever, like, you know. But listen to your clients, and you don't have to have the answer. Don't bullshit them.
That's right.
I think it's a big thing for you, just like you said there now, like asking. Asking somebody. Personal trainers become so closed. They feel that they're actually demeaning themselves, or they're lowering their ego by asking for help.
I would come from that kind of background. Like, I wouldn't have went to seminars. Like, I would have read a bit, but I wouldn't have went to seminars. I wouldn't have reached out to help, and I should have done. So it was a mistake I made for a long time, and I can see why they're dragged into that. You know, but see, once I did open the doors and started reaching out,
I think if you have the mindset, and I've always had it, is obviously I just wanted to learn, but always knowing that, right, I don't know enough. I need to keep learning and having that type of mindset, and it always just made me actually go and just research and going to courses and different and traveling around and
when you go to that course and all of a sudden they say something, you're like, oh crap, that's Mary. Oh crap,
exactly.
And then you start, and then, like Owen said, on the left hand side, you're writing down the cute things that you remember straight away. You've got Mary, you're like, I fucking know what that's about.
You were saying some things yesterday that you recognise in a client, like, and I study a client when they come in and I would ask about their history and stuff, but some of the things that you said that you look at when we talked about adrenal glands and stuff, and I was just like, fuck, that totally makes sense about your client. You know?
And this is the thing, like, that question about sweating in bed. Like, why would a trainer know that? Well, maybe I'm sitting down with someone and says, I'm sweating all the time in bed. And then I look it up, and then I contact one doctor, and then I contact a sleep guy, and then it comes together. You don't just learn that by accident, you know?
And if you said that and it came down to the calorie model, what do you do? Do you know what I mean? You go, well, here's all I know, and it's this, it's move more and eat less, and, you know, get your work, and someone says you're sweating in bed, and you're like, well, just eat less.
Open the window.
Turn the heat off.
One of the things we used to put in the presentation was a slide after the GTI principle yesterday. It was the Lee rule. And I took it out because sometimes people got a bit confused by it. But basically what the Lee rule stands for, you have to learn from everybody. Like, you have to learn from everybody. From teaching for years with the Pollock and for Charles, it was one way. And then when I started teaching myself, I said, it's not just one way. You have to learn from everybody. So what I used to do was, when I was working with Charles, I go off and I did an internship with Louis Simmons over in Westside Barbell. What I have to do about powerlifting is nothing, but I want to understand his method. Then I go to Olympic coaches, then I go to track and field guys, then I go to Dr. Serrano. So you learn from everybody. Then you have to experiment. And we would show people how to use chains, for example, chains in a bar, accommodating resistance. Are they the best form of training? No, they're just different. But maybe if you're training a client that wants to maybe have something different, you can add them in. But there's a certain level of strength. I see some people putting chains on an empty bar. It's not really what it's meant to be used.
Because you're doing it, your client has to do it. You know.
And then you have to realize that everybody is different. So I'm here and I'm talking about my clients and Adam's clients and our gym clients, but they're different than yours. Yours. So you have to realize that when these train, you're learning stuff online off these trainers about their, how to deal with their clients. That's their clients in their gym, in their environment, at their group, at their rate, at their experience. So look after your clients.
It was something that I took away from yourself, which was actually do your programs out for your clients. No, there's a lot of guys that are doing fancy programs with Olympic lifts, and they've got Agnes coming on who's 56, never been in a gym before, and it's just again kind of purely feeding their ego. No, it's like, right, look at my program, it's got all these exercises, when it means nothing to the person that they're trying to train.
And I see people jumping on boxes. Here I go again, I'm going to go off on one. People jumping on boxes. they don't have the knee, ankle, hip, core strength to do that. You're opening their risk of injury because it's, it looks good jumping on a bike.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a massive achievement if they do it, but like I seen a video from somebody that I know, and he had one of his clients trying to jump on a box and I won't use a name, but she's standing up against the box and she's like, oh, I don't know, let's just say James. So I don't know James, I don't know James. And I was shit you not, in the video, he goes, just jump in the fucking box. So she jumped of fear, crack. Wooden box, knees to the box. Like chin. And I was like, oh yeah, my God.
I've been at fault there for sure. The back in the boot camp days of the boxes, when there were 60, 80 people in a big massive class and everybody jumping mad. And there was a lot of shins damage for sure.
Yeah.
Look,
so what's coming up next for, you have the summit now in May 11th,
May 11th and 12th down in Dublin. We have our summit. We've changed the name from the ISOI Symposium because the initials were ISIS and that's not good for promotion. So it's the ISOI Health Summit now.
Yeah.
And we're going to have at least a minimum of 12 speakers over the weekend. We're going to have 4 days in total. So it'll be 2 days for the main summit, and then we're going to have a practical day on Friday and a practical day on the Monday. So that's what that's
can you tell what guys you're bringing over?
So Dr. Serrano is going to be there. We have Dr. Nigel Plummer coming. We have
Ken Kanakin.
We have
Kerry Jones.
She's Dutch. the Dutch
medical officer.
Medical officer. She's going to speak on female hormones.
Yeah.
Ben Sapolsky. Who else have we got? We have Kitman Labs.
Fella called Don Lacey's coming.
He might show his face. Yeah. We have John Kavanagh from SBG. He's going to be presenting.
Brilliant.
We have a few other guys that we have to just
Luke Lehman, he's on too, isn't he?
Yeah, Luke.
Oh, Luke,
on.
Yeah.
Luke's going to be
cool.
There.
Cool. Excellent. And where could someone purchase tickets?
Well, it's on the Irish Strength Institute
website,
yeah, and on our Instagram.
Cool.
Also, myself and him, we haven't done it in a while. We're actually doing an Algarve retreat.
Yeah, right.
From the 19th to the 26th, which is just after the symposium. So
that's in May as well, was it?
Yeah.
That's in May as well, yeah. That's... Again, you've been there, but we have a new setup in a hotel and a new gym facility right on the beach. It's quality.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's a great trip. Yeah.
And who would that be for, Owen, mainly?
Mainly it's for people just looking to get in shape, looking to have a healthy holiday, basically. So we train twice a day over 6 days. Food's all included. Apart from dinner, you'll have to do your own thing at dinner time.
Cool.
But for detox, for muscle building, fat loss, and it's just a good
break. But even from an educational point of view, like we get trainers coming on them as well, like, you know, because it gives you a little bit of it's probably a way to kind of go home with 3 months worth of programming, because we always mix it up, like, you know, and it's explained to, you know, and that's another thing with what we've been talking about with clients as well and trainers, like, you know, don't tell your client to do something, because just do it. You know, don't be afraid to explain things. Over there, like, I do a presentation, so I've done two last year, and we let it dry up for about 3 years. So last year I got the two going, and then we're getting back into this year and just get the numbers up. You know,
good.
That first time I went was a brilliant trip. What was it, 10 days?
You did 10 day internship.
You had a fat loss running, but you had the internship running at the same time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Brilliant. And what dates is that again this year?
Technically the 20th to the 25th, but then 19th to the 26th is what the flying day. It's like, you know, so. And it's just right before season, so the weather's always good. The costs are a little bit cheaper. Like, you know, to go in season, you're looking at double the cost. It's ridiculous. Like,
cool, excellent, lads.
Other than that, the only other thing is something that we've been playing around with is the trainer
apprenticeship.
Like, you know, so, like, we've even talked to John Carroll and whatnot, like, you know, about up and coming trainers, and again, every month or every 2 months meeting up with something like that. So that's definitely something we're looking into. So
yeah, it's definitely something we could probably collaborate on as well too, with a guest.
For sure.
So this will be education in terms of the nutrition and programming.
Yeah,
and so
a bit of everything, really. Like, you know, so program design, nutrition, rehab, like, you know. Like, when people say health, what does health mean? Like, you know, and like for me, health for Agnes is getting Agnes more range of motion in her knees.
Yeah.
So that she can get up off the chair if she wants to. Like, you know, she falls, she can get back up, you know.
It's much more focused. It won't be like me standing there going off on one. It'll be Adam talking. This is all on energy systems, the whole day on that. And then writing programs.
So, of course,
And then one on rehabilitation, one on anatomy, one on program design, rather than me talking about sweating in bed
But like you said there earlier on, like, now that there is less fixed machines, like, talking about stabilizers, like, you know, like, and you've seen us do some funky shit on Instagram, like, you know, like, four stabilizers and quite a lot of it that I've learned from Dr. Serrano personally, like, you know, but it's really different. But yeah, it's so fucking basic, like, basic, you know, but just nobody's doing it, like, because you don't lift a lot of weight in them, and it is embarrassing when you're failing on 1 kilo dumbbells. But you know what, if they get your shoulder stable and it makes you put an extra 5 kilos on your bench, well then, happy days. You know, so
exactly.
Excellent. Cheers, lads.
Guys, thanks very much for coming in, man.
It was good podcast. And even yesterday too, the seminar was fantastic. Lots of fantastic feedback from the seminar yesterday. So it'd be good to get you up again.
Yeah,
for sure.
Definitely.
That's great.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Cheers.